Somewhere between serendipity and good planning lies the road to success. You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Hello and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Raymond Francis, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. When NASA's Opportunity rover landed on Mars in January 2004, its target was a flat, open plain named Meridiani Planum. By chance, it settled into a small and previously unknown impact crater, a rare location of exposed bedrock in a wide expanse of sand and dust. For geologists looking to understand the history of this part of Mars, it was a tremendously valuable accident that changed the entire course of the work to follow. Robotic probes like the Opportunity rover don't travel to their destinations alone. Their every operation is selected, commanded, and monitored by teams of scientists and engineers on Earth. And like the sequences of instructions sent to the rover, a career that leads to the job of operating a spacecraft depends on careful planning and chance opportunities. Kerry Bean is a planetary scientist who has worked on several robotic missions even while still a student. Already she's learned the influence that good planning and unexpected opportunities can have on how things turn out, both in life and in mission control. I spoke to Kerry in her office at the Texas A&M University in College Station, Texas, about how to run a Mars mission and how to get to run a Mars mission. So hi, and welcome to the show.
Hello.
I know that you work on MSL because we met through that mission, but you started out, your first mission that you worked on was?
Phoenix.
Very good. And how did you get into that one?
My advisor just kind of dragged me along.
Yeah?
He has a tendency to kind of throw you into the deep end and let you figure out how to swim, but, you know, it's obviously worked out. So he's kind of been dragging me along to mission operations and also doing research for a whole bunch of different spacecraft. So technically started out doing some data analysis for Spirit and Opportunity, but real operations, the first one was Phoenix.
Okay. And what kind of ops were you doing? What were you doing on Phoenix?
On Phoenix, I was a Surface Stereo Imager Instrument Downlink Analyst, or SSI-IDA, because NASA loves acronyms.
SSI is one of the cameras?
Yes. Yeah. It was the color stereo camera that was on the lander. I was almost going to say rover.
Right.
I'm used to saying rover at this point. No, but Phoenix was a lander, landed kind of near the North Pole of Mars, and it was solar-powered, so we knew it had a very limited lifetime because we were above the Arctic Circle, so the sun would eventually set and not come back up, which isn't really good for a solar-powered mission.
Yeah.
So we knew we had a limited lifetime, but we took lots of interesting pictures on Phoenix. A lot of what I was concerned about with Phoenix imaging was actually looking at the dust devils that we saw with Phoenix.
Oh, did you see some from Phoenix?
Yes.
Okay.
Lots of them. It was very cool.
And you caught them with SSI?
Yes.
So why are those interesting?
They tell us a little bit about the surface heating of Mars. You need a lot of surface heating to cause these little vortices that have to become strong enough to pick up the dust off the surface. It's also a way that dust gets into the atmosphere. We're very interested in the dust cycle of Mars, especially in the atmosphere. And so we wanted to look for these dust devils. We also saw them with the pressure sensor that we had, but we also got to see lots of them. I don't remember the exact number off the top of my head, but I want to say we saw over 40 of them.
Okay.
With the camera.
In a mission that was about 80 days long?
151 days total.
Okay. So every few days you managed to pick one up, or were they all towards the end of the mission, or?
They were kind of all towards the end of the mission. We had lots of storms come through towards the end as the North Pole started to grow in size. It got colder. We had more, like, not storm fronts coming through. So we got to see, as these fronts came through, we saw lots of dust devils increase and then kind of fade off a little bit. And then the next storm would come through and you'd see a peak in dust devils. So it was pretty cool getting to see these peaks and the storms coming through. And
with these missions, we hear a lot about the rocks, but it sounds like you were able to almost monitor the weather on Mars.
Yes. Well, since Phoenix didn't move, it was a lander. Once you kind of image the site, you know, except for the trenches that it was digging, you didn't really have much else to look at except the sky.
You've pretty much seen all the rocks you're going to see.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, obviously we did lots of imaging of the trenches. It's, you know, we dug them. But a lot of the time, especially towards the end of the mission, was spent looking at the sky, looking for clouds and dust devils and all sorts of things.
Okay. And are they very active? Are these violent, these dust devils, or do they just kind of drift by?
They wouldn't be very violent. You could definitely withstand being in one. It wouldn't be very good for your spacesuit because it would get a whole bunch of dirt and gunk into it. So you would prefer to stay out of their way, but it wouldn't hurt you if you were hit by one.
What if you're a spacecraft sitting there? Is it bad for Phoenix?
It wasn't really bad for Phoenix. We actually have images. We were looking at our telltale instrument that tells us the wind direction, and we think we actually got hit by a dust devil while taking these pictures because you can see the whole spacecraft shaking.
Oh, that's interesting.
But it didn't do any damage to the spacecraft. It was just kind of cool to see, you know, it was kind of sitting there, and all of a sudden, you know, it's tilted at 90 degrees, and then, you know, the next picture, it's back down.
Right, that telltale was that sort of little windsock hanging there.
Yeah.
Right. So that was Phoenix, and now you're working on Mars Science Lab. Do you have a similar job there?
A little bit. I've kind of graduated along in responsibilities going from an undergrad student to a graduate student. So with MSL, I actually kind of have two different responsibilities. My main responsibility, I would say, is environmental science team responsibilities. This is the team that takes care of looking at the atmosphere and kind of the situation around Gale Crater. So, you know, not looking at rocks or anything like that. That's left to the geologists. But anything else is pretty much covered by our group. And so with the environment group, there's a couple different roles within it that I've done. One of them is the environmental theme lead, where you kind of take charge of the group for the day. You kind of lead all the different scientists to come up with a plan for the day, what observations you want to do. And then you put this into the planning software, which is usually the job for the second person, which is called the keeper of the plan, or COP. And this person works with the in-house software, puts the observations into the plan, and then the theme lead goes into the various meetings of the day and defends your observations. You know, usually we plan twice as much of what we can do in a day, and you have to kind of fight it out and get it down to what MSL can actually do in a day. So you kind of fight for your right to take pictures.
So a lot of sort of strategy and planning about which measurements to take.
Yes. And then the second role is kind of more of an engineering role. I work as a MassCam payload uplink lead.
Okay.
And with that, we take care of the MassCam observations. So regardless of who has proposed it, you know, if it's a geologist looking at rocks or someone looking at the sun, you would work with the engineers and the scientists to kind of make sure that the observation fits what they actually want to do. If you want to take a picture of that rock, you obviously want to make sure that you're taking a picture of that rock and it's not pointed wrong. Or you want to make sure the camera's in focus and just kind of take care of all the variables the scientists may not know as well as you would being on the mass camp.
All the little technical settings that go into getting the right picture.
Right.
So you talked about choosing observations for the environment group. What kinds of observations can you make of the Martian environment with MSL?
We can do quite a bit. The MassCam is certainly capable of doing a whole bunch of different things. It is a bigger pattern camera, so it is automatically color by default. It used to be that we would have a red, green, and blue color filter that we'd stack on top of each other to get false color. Well, now we have true color images. But we still do have a filter wheel on the front to look for various wavelengths, and especially into the near infrared that can tell us some properties about rocks. We also have solar filters so we can look at the sun safely without burning out the cameras, because that would definitely be a bad thing.
Yeah, that sounds like a useful feature.
Yes. So we can look at the sun. This is especially important when we did the transits of Phobos and Deimos across the sun. So we took a 720p, you know, HD video of the transits. There was three clustered around Sol 37 and 42, and they are gorgeous in this video.
These little moons passing in front of the sun?
Yes. So that I worked a lot with that because we had to kind of figure out how long does it take to boot up the camera? How long does it, you know, you can't miss the transit. You know what time it is. And we wanted to make sure the camera was on and running during that time and not, you know, coming on too early or too late. So we did a lot of engineering work to figure out what was the optimal time to turn it on and say, let's go.
Okay. And what about some of the other instruments? How are they used to study the environment?
There's a whole bunch of different ways. We bake and shake and zap all the different rocks and soils that we can find to figure out the mineralogy of Mars, and that tells you a lot about the history of Mars, whether it's a wet environment. And they just did a press release a couple weeks ago from telling us that, yes, we did find a nice neutral pH, habitable, well, potentially habitable environment of Mars. So it was pretty cool, you know, seeing the geologists really geek out over that, you know, and the environment group has somewhat of a role in that. We have an instrument called DAN that looks for neutrons underground, and that tells you if there's water in the soil. So it's pretty interesting to kind of see all these observations come together.
Okay. So you're working on the missions, but this is because you are a scientist who does research of your own. So what's your focus now as a grad student?
Right now I'm trying to finish my master's thesis, and my master's thesis is on nighttime optical depth on Mars using images from SPIRIT. And what this is SPIRIT took a whole bunch of pictures at night of constellations you would recognize, like Orion. And in those images, we set them to about a minute exposure, so there's little tiny star streaks in the images. And we take that and we bend the pixels so we get a brightness of how bright the star is on the ground that we're seeing. And we compare that to the brightness that the Hubble Space Telescope has seen. And that would be the brightness in space versus the brightness on the ground. And that tells you how much of the star radiation is being blocked by the atmosphere. And that tells you a little bit if there's clouds in the atmosphere, how much dust is in the atmosphere. That tells you, you know, a whole bunch of different things. So that's a lot of what I'm working on.
Okay. So understanding how much material is being carried in the air.
Yes.
So I guess my first question is, does it ever get to be completely opaque that you can't see the stars? Do you get overcast days?
Definitely. You can see variation even within an image. It's about a 25-degree image, and in that you can see variations in the stars from the top of the image to the bottom of the image.
Some of them are more blocked than others.
Yes. So, you know, the obvious answer that I see is that clouds are passing in part of the image and, you know, increasing the optical depth in parts. So that's kind of cool to see these clouds going by at night. And since SPIRIT was a solar-powered mission, you could only see them during the summer. This would be the only time that we would have enough power to wake up at night. So with Curiosity being nuclear powered, we aren't as worried about that as much. So hopefully within the next few months, we'll really start being able to do this research with Curiosity too.
Okay, nighttime sky observations. And
yeah.
How else can you try and estimate the amount of material in the atmosphere?
The common way is actually to take a picture of the sun at different wavelengths and at different angles in the atmosphere. SPIRIT and Opportunity actually took a picture just about every day at noon. It was a requirement because of their solar power, and the engineers would take that optical depth number to guess how much power they would have, so they wouldn't plan more than the power that they would receive.
Oh, so actually part of the planning, just to characterize the environment for that purpose.
Yeah. So it was an engineering request, but also it has a lot of useful science in it, too. And you can definitely see as, like, the major dust storms come through, you see these huge spikes in optical depth, and there's pictures of the sun where you can't really tell the sun is there. Like, we know it is pointing at the sun, but you can't really see it because it's so blocked. But
And that dust is very scattering, isn't it? Like, it instead of having a bright spot, you can end up with a huge, bright sort of sky that's almost all the same brightness.
Yeah, there's been a couple of sunrise and sunset pictures taken by SPIRIT and Opportunity, and very gorgeous pictures. And what I find really interesting is the colors or the sunset are actually kind of inverted from what you'd think, or at least what you'd experience here on Earth. So, you know, here on Earth, it's usually sky is normally blue and then it kind of fades to red at night. Well, on Mars, it's kind of the reverse. The sky is normally kind of a pinky red and then it turns into blue at night.
Oh,
at
really?
Sunset.
Why
so, the dust is usually pretty big compared to what is normally in Earth's atmosphere. And Earth's atmosphere does what's called Rayleigh scattering. And it's the wavelength of the sun, or the radiation coming off the sun, hits particles and bounces off. And what we see in our eyes is about the wavelength that the dust particles are, because it bounces perfectly with that radiation. So on Mars, since the dust particles are huge in the atmosphere, they deflect a different type of light. So it's red instead of blue.
Okay.
And when you go towards the horizon, a lot of that red light has been blocked off as it's going through the atmosphere, since it has a longer path through the atmosphere. Yeah.
Okay.
And so what's left is the blue light. So
interesting.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've yet to see an artist's conception that captured that reversal.
Yeah.
So do we know why it is that the dust is forming these larger particles on Mars than it might on the Earth?
Well, probably the dust is somewhat similar to here on Earth, especially if you're looking at, like, the Sahara Desert. But the dust isn't as widespread here on Earth as it is on Mars. You know, the whole Mars planet is pretty much dust
right
on the surface, whereas Earth, it's mostly ocean. So, you know, if we had more dust and more, like, desert areas, it probably, you know, we would see a lot more of the effects of the dust in the atmosphere.
Okay. So you mentioned that when you were working on Phoenix, you were an undergraduate student.
Yes.
So how did you get to be working on a space mission so early in your career?
I wasn't afraid to ask.
I've just kind of
been forward about everything. I came to an event called Aggieland Saturday, and this was where high school seniors and juniors come visit Texas A&M and kind of meet professors and, you know, learn a lot about the school. And I was wearing a NASA hoodie when I came my senior year, and this professor said, "Oh, do you like NASA and space stuff?" And I was like, "Yeah, it's really cool." And the professor I was talking to said, "Well, you should go talk to this Mark Lemon guy. I don't know what he does, but it's space stuff and it's cool." And I'm like, "All right." So I went home and I looked up his profile and my jaw dropped. He worked on missions since Galileo. You know, he's been doing Mars imaging since Pathfinder. And I was like, I have to meet this guy. So I sent him an email. I was like, "I am like the most space-obsessed person ever. I wear my space camp uniform all the time. Like, I am ready to go." And he met with me that summer and kind of did, I guess, sort of a job interview, although I didn't know it was going to be a job interview. He was asking me, you know, what sort of programming skills do you have? What did you take in high school? Just kind of get to know me. And he said, "When you start in the fall, you know, come by my office and you can listen into the Mars Rover planning meetings." And I was excited. So I came my freshman year, my first week, I sat down in his office and I listened to a Spirit and Opportunity science planning meeting.
Really?
And I did not understand pretty much anything that had happened because it was all in acronyms and, you know, shortcuts and everything. But I was like, this is so cool. And I went to several meetings. He gave me some scientific papers to read. He's like, "You know, don't worry too much about the math right now. Just, you know, if you have any trouble, feel free to come get help." And so I, you know, read all these papers. Like, I don't understand the math, but this is so cool. And, you know, showed that I was really interested and dedicated. And then he started me off on a very basic research project. I just had to, like, click on the same type of part of the terrain in a certain image. And, you know, there's, like, 2,000 pictures of this particular thing. And so I had to go through and sort through them all. And then after winter break, I came back and he's like, "What are you doing over spring break?" And I was like, "Nothing really." And he was like, "Okay, well, do you want to go to this Lunar and Planetary Science Conference?" And I was like, "Sure, I don't know what that is, but, you know, I'll learn a whole bunch." And I went by myself, which was terrifying, but I got to meet lots of professional contacts there. I got to meet Steve Squires, the PI of the Mars Rovers, and I was so excited to meet him because I just read his biography about working on the mission. I was so excited. And then when I got back from that, and I said, "You know, I learned all this. You know, I'm still kind of confused about these subjects," but and he kind of explained them to me. And he's like, "So what are you doing this summer?" I was like, "Nothing really. I was planning on taking some summer class." He's like, "How would you like to work operations on the Phoenix Mars Lander?" I was like, "Do you really have to ask?"
Yeah.
So he's just kind of been doing that continually. "Hey, would you like to do this?" And I'm like, "Okay. Like, did you have to ask?" So, yeah.
Well, that's good. I mean, that's a fabulous opportunity for an early career for an undergraduate student.
Oh, absolutely. The landing day of Phoenix was 1 year to the date after I graduated from high school. So,
wow,
you know,
and you were working on the mission.
Yeah. May 25th, 2007, I graduated high school. May 25th, 2008, I was sitting in mission control for Phoenix, putting the images as they were landing and coming down to the ground on the screen for the scientists to look at. And I was like, what happened? What did I do?
So if you've already done working on a few missions already this early in your career, what's left? What do you want to fit into your career before you're all done?
I really don't know. I really like working on spacecraft, so I hope to kind of continue doing that in the future. Maybe getting a PhD. I'm not really sure yet. I guess, you know, we'll see what the future brings.
Right.
But I really hope that I don't have to give up working on missions because it's definitely been super fun. Living on Mars time is so fun.
It's exciting stuff. Well, good luck. And I hope you are able to keep working on missions. And I hope we see each other when
yes.
we're doing that. Thanks.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
Carrie Bean's still pretty early in her career, but she's already had quite some adventures on Mars.
Yep. Very interesting interview.
Yeah, it's great to be able to see someone who's able to jump in with both feet that early on. Already worked on operations for two missions, data from a third. Not everybody gets to do that in undergrad, even.
I know.
Or master's or
that's
PhD
right.
sometimes.
And she carried on her enthusiasm throughout her work. And you can tell from her voice that she's very enthusiastic about space, Mars, NASA.
It helps to be enthusiastic when you're up at 3 in the morning. Made it down from, yeah.
Living on Martian time.
That's right, living on Mars time for sure, yeah. Yeah, but
she seems to like it.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, enthusiasm certainly helps.
One thing that really, really interests me, or I should say I loved it about her, was that she said that you always need to ask. Mm-hmm. You know, she was in high school when she first went to Texas A&M to just look around what profs, you know, are doing there. And she asked people about, you know, what do you guys do? What could I do, you know, if I would come here? And that's where her journey started. And I think that's really important for people who are not only in high school at this moment, but also for college undergrads or even grad students, I should say.
Yeah.
Just, like, try put yourself in different situations, yeah. You know, just
the worst someone
explore.
Can say is no, right?
Yeah.
So why not ask? I mean, I thought it was really, I guess, brave of her to send that email, right, to say, hey, what do you got going on? Is there anything I can do? Like, that's pretty cool that she was able to do that.
Yeah, but it shows interest and enthusiasm.
Yeah, look what's come out of it for her. I mean, she got to work on Phoenix. You know, it landed 1 year after she graduated high school, and here she was working on the Phoenix mission. And then to be able to work on MSL, I mean, it's incredible.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the other thing is, yeah, certainly seek out opportunities. And when someone presents you with one, say yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Never.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Even if you don't like it, never turn it down, because you never know what you're going to learn from it.
Or where it leads to in the future.
Yeah, yes. That's right. True as well. Yeah, I mean, you would never imagine, like, you know, an undergrad project can turn into your career. Maybe you might have not imagined to go into that field, but, you know, you never know. You start liking it maybe later. I know some people who have, you know, started being in astronomy but worked on physics, and now they're doing PhD in physics. They never imagined, you know, getting into physics. They always loved astronomy, but it led to their, you know, doctorate in physics. So you never know.
Right.
Where it leads to.
The more things you try, the more things, you know, you do or don't like, right?
Yeah,
so you can kind of narrow down where you want to go with life. One of the interesting things I found about the interview overall was the stuff that she was doing was not the normal stuff we normally hear come out of Mars research, right? Usually we talk about the rocks and geology and stuff like that, but here she's looking at atmospheric and environmental effects, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, the rocks get all the attention on Mars, but there is, in fact, an atmosphere.
Yeah.
And it is, in fact, interesting.
Yes.
Believe me. Yeah, the dust devils, when they first started seeing them some years ago, they caught a lot of attention, but not finding them all the time at Phoenix.
Yeah, I didn't realize that Phoenix had seen so many of them.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. And that it got hit by one.
Yeah, it seems so. Which is, you know, and it survived. So, good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, even, I guess, when the, you know, one of the rovers had at least one interaction with the dust devil. It seems to have lifted some of the dust off its solar panels.
Yeah, I think that was Spirit.
I think it was.
But yeah, that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really like when she was talking about how they actually look at stars to figure out what kind of, you know, what's going on in the atmosphere. Like, mm-hmm. if there are clouds building up, or are there clouds coming in or going out, just by looking at stars. And what kind of stars do you see? You know, what's the brightness and things like that, mm-hmm. can actually tell you a lot about the atmosphere. And I didn't think that's what people would do, you know, looking at stars from Mars and trying to figure out what's going on in the atmosphere.
Yeah, and of course that surface stereo imager or even the cameras on the rovers are not designed for looking at stars, right? But you use the tools that you have to do what you want to do and everything you can do, right?
Yeah, in fact, there was a grad student here when I was doing grad school who used the cameras on Spirit or Opportunity, I can't remember which, to try to look for meteors.
Oh, yeah.
In the Martian atmosphere.
Any success?
I don't think that they found one, or they found one, but it was still interesting nonetheless that they used those tools for a purpose that it wasn't initially supposed to be used for, or the idea wasn't there anyway, and, you know, that's pretty cool.
And when they designed the Hubble telescope, I don't think anyone expected that its images would be used to cross-calibrate the brightness of Mars rover images of stars.
That's right.
Right? But use what you got, right?
Yeah, that's true.
What's fun is that you can do that kind of research while also being involved in the active operations of the mission. When you're doing that, you learn a lot about how the mission works and how you get the data and where it comes from, and you get the chance to influence the generation of that data, which makes the data better. It's really cool that she's able to be on both sides.
Yeah, it definitely is going to give her nice breadth of experience and background. So, like, she's when talking about her future, you know, she doesn't necessarily have to stick with one or the other. She can do both.
That's right.
And hopefully be able to do both.
Well, and in fact, since we did the interview, she's completed her graduate studies, and she's now been hired at JPL to do science operations for the Dawn mission.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she just started in early August. So.
Okay, so is she doing imaging stuff? Or?
I don't know the details of what it is. It's science ops, kind of planning, and probably pretty similar to what she's doing.
Cool.
But she's announced this on Twitter, so.
Oh, okay.
So we're not scooping her on this. Yeah.
But yeah, I found it really interesting how they actually have a set of operations for the day for the Mars rover, and then they have to pick and choose because they don't know how much or how long each operation would take, and so they have a bunch, and then they pick stuff.
Yep.
So I think that was really cool. And then, like, there are people who actually, you know, sit there and pick what the Mars rover would do, and then there are people who actually punch it in and say, okay, the Mars rover needs to do this and this.
That's right.
Yeah, yep. So I think that was really cool. And being a student, I mean, you know, she was a student when she was doing this. That's a really cool job.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
To be part of that decision-making, that's really cool.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, there's 470-odd members of the science team.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's going to have ideas about what data, which rock is the best to take a picture of and which other thing you want to do.
Right.
And the rover has only so much data, only so much power, and only so much time. And other rules that you can only achieve so much. And so you have to downsample and you have to make choices at the tactical daily level and at the larger weeks and months level of what you do. And every decision you make affects how much you will learn from this mission.
Yeah.
A mission that has a finite life and a very high cost of replacement. So.
Yeah, and I really like the idea. I mean, we have talked this before as well, that just as an example, she being a student, she's on the team of decision making. There are people from different walks of life, or at least I should say walks of sciences, being there and taking decisions of what kind of sciences the rover can do. That's really, really interesting because it's not just one person deciding what I can do with this one instrument.
Mm-hmm.
It's different people with different ideas and different ways to use this one, probably just one instrument.
Yeah.
It really is a collaborative effort, right? Which is something that planetary science is kind of all about, which is nice. It's not just these silos of people who are battling over what to do. It's, you know, engineers and scientists. And scientists being geologists and astronomers and atmospheric scientists, I guess, all working together to try to figure out what's the best use of the rover's time and power abilities and everything else.
Yeah, and if you can make that kind of collaboration work, then you should get a more optimal result than leaving it to one person to make the decisions, right? You need all of those skills and all of that knowledge. You're trying to get some of everything and the best results. So, of course, having all that input, if you can make it work, should give you that best result.
Yeah, I think in this era where everyone is so specific in what they do, in terms of, you know, if you have a doctorate, you're very specific to even in one area of what you're actually doing. So you don't really have, even though you have the vision of what's going on around, but if you have different people from different fields that can come and, you know, work on the same project, but with different ideas.
Yeah.
That's.
And the mission makes you do that, right? You've got a science team, people with, again, working in different domains. But they have to interact very well with the engineering team.
Yeah.
Because it's the engineers who will actually prepare the plan and upload it to the rover. They need to understand the goals of the scientists, and the scientists need to understand the limitations that the engineers are bound by with the system. And so, yeah, you have to be able to talk across disciplines to work in there. And if you begin training them when they're students, so much the better.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. Western Worlds was created by John Moores. This episode was produced by Parshati Patel and Michael Forster and featured an interview by co-host Raymond Francis. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Alyssa Gilbert, Raymond Francis, Parshati Patel, and Zengyi Hu. Our editor was Parshati Patel and I'm Raymond Francis. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website at cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are @WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can once again make world enough and time for us next week, right here on astronomy.fm.